We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm your guest host, Stephen Lyons. Today we have the pleasure of having a conversation with Patrick Smith, the author of Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Postmodern World. The book has just been published by Pantheon Books. Patrick Smith is the author of The Nippon Challenge and Japan, a Reinterpretation, which won the Overseas Press Club Award and the Kurayama Prize. He's written for the International Herald Tribune, The New Yorker, The Nation, Business Week, The Economist, The Far Eastern Economic Review, and The Washington Quarterly, among many other publications. He lives in Hong Kong and New York. In mid-August of this year, a news story caught my attention. The headline was, China passes Japan as second largest economy. Certainly the news was not unexpected after three decades of spectacular growth by China. Perhaps more unexpected was that Japan was still a dominant economic force in the world. Most experts agree that by 2030, India will surpass Japan as the second largest economy, also not unexpected. China has a long ways to go still to catch the United States as the largest economy. China's economy is valued at $1.33 trillion compared to our $14 trillion economy. China's per capita income is $3,600 a year in the neighborhood of Albania or El Salvador compared to our $46,000 annually. Still, the trend has huge ramifications for the West. China has already passed us for the dubious honor of emitting the most greenhouse gases upon our beleaguered planet, while at the same time leading an ambitious program to cut energy use and build up a green industry that I know we will someday envy and scramble to catch up to. But today's guest, Patrick Smith, would say that what I'm doing by quoting these trends and numbers is so myopically Western. By looking at GNPs, per capita incomes, and percentages of energy use, I'm looking at this area the way we often do with India and China, melded together as Chindia, 2 billion people, as simply a statistic. Patrick Smith writes that this Western view of the East is economically centered, shaped primarily by business executives and policy planners, essentially the same group. It's a Western notion of progress, growth, and then more growth. Our guest suggests there's a different way we need to view the East, a way that allows room for the infinite variety of humanity, religions, histories, and institutions. I recently reviewed our guest's book and wrote, "All of this shifting of world power from east to west is a clarion call for the United States to also remake itself. This will not come easy because it implies we are no longer the biggest, toughest nation on the planet. Yet, how's that working for us lately?" Mr. Smith foresees a new balance in the East-West dialogue, one in which the East transcends old ideals of nationhood, another Western import. Our influence is waning. Asia's is growing. He asserts that there are fundamental lessons in Asia's long struggle with the modern. In the 21st century, the East will challenge the West just as the West once challenged the East. To join our discussion, call 333-9455 or toll free at 800-222-9455. As a further way of introducing our guest, let me read a small excerpt from Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Postmodern World. "Asia as it is, then, to be part of it has nothing to do with skin color, the shape of one's eyes, shop houses, strong family ties, and still less with anything so modern as national frontiers, which do not come naturally to Asians and often sit awkwardly upon their lands and seas. Nothing so fixed comes into it. Better to think of a large part of the planet in constant flux, a part that is by definition without definition. The as it is always changing. Fixedness, our new central require us to recognize, is a Western trope." Patrick Smith, welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you very much, and thanks, obviously, for your interest in the book, Stephen.
I found your three essays in this book so original, so richly layered with ideas, that I had to read sections over and over again, and yet I'm...
I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
That's the highest compliment I think a reader can give.
Thank you.
There are huge concepts that you have tackled, and there is nothing quite stable or linear about them, I could say Western about them. How did you come to write this book? And I understand you've been living and working in Asia for 30 years.
Yes, just about 30. I want to say something with all due courtesy before we begin. The subtitle is East and West in a Post-Western World. Postmodern, I find a very spongy sort of term, and I know it comes readily to us, but I've never quite understood what it meant. And post-Western has quite a pointed meaning. We can pick that thought up later in our conversation. How did I come to write it? Well, as a newspaper correspondent, I was in Asia, you come to a point where you have accumulated much more knowledge than your newspaper is going to be interested in, and that's not the fault of any newspaper. I used to think it was, but of course it's not. They're interested in news. And so you begin looking for another vessel, you know, longer essays or books or whatever. And I was forming an idea for a book along the lines of the one we're discussing, but it was from a Westerner's point of view, and my agent said, no, Patrick, you've been out there a very long time. Tell us what the world looks like when you're sitting in Asia. And I thought, well, I'm a Westerner. It might be a rather impudent or arrogant undertaking, but she's quite right. I think I can try that. And it's what you're holding in your hands now. I wanted to describe how the world looked from the other side of it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be an interesting contribution. And as I finished it, I came to think, maybe I'm not altogether a Westerner anymore myself after all these years in the East. And now that I'm back in the States and very happy to be, I think that's probably so.
It came across that way, Patrick. It seemed like deep reporting to me. I mean, this is not a book somebody could write with even 5 years' experience. And I want to ask you some general questions about Asia and then get into some specific questions about each of the three countries that you've chosen. First, why did you choose Japan, China, and India to represent the East? I mean, why not Vietnam, Indonesia? Then there's, on the other side of the grid, off the grid, is Burma, North Korea.
Right. Well, I wanted to choose, it's a bit broad brush here, Stephen, but I wanted to choose cultures, or as I say in the book, I don't know what to call them, cultures, societies, civilizations, or nations, that were in some way seminal, off of which hung others, okay? I wanted a certain minimalism to the book so that Western readers could grasp the thoughts without a lot of clutter. So India, okay, as I indicated in the book, some of the things I say about India may reflect on Pakistan or Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose Japan. It was the first non-Western nation to industrialize, modernize, if you like, and is so exemplary in so many ways of the experience others were to have after it. China, an obvious choice, the Middle Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
and India, a very singular country in some ways, brilliantly fated to sit between East and West. One envies the Indians for their fortunes in that regard. And a little secret I didn't put into the book. I actually intended to put a fourth on Iran because my travels in Iran were quite remarkable. It's a very fine country, in my view, full of very fine people. And what I found in Iran was actually quite remarkably similar in ways we would never think. The Iranian difficulties with modernization are rather unexpectedly similar to Japan's experience 100 and more years ago. I thought that's something to say, and it would have given the book reach from Western Asia all the way over to Tokyo Bay. But the research occurred during the Bush administration years, and visas were kind of collateral damage in all our bickering. And I didn't get one. But in the end, I was quite pleased, because once again, I thought, had I included Iran, the book might have lost some of the unity and simplicity that I really wanted to offer readers. And so it was a sort of happy misfortune, if you will. Iran can come another time, right? So I took the three, and I think it gives the book some shape, and I hope will lead the reader into an understanding of Asia or the East.
We're speaking with Patrick Smith, the author of Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Post-Western World. You talk about the 150 history of West-East contact. I thought that was an interesting frame of time. Are you specifically talking about U.S. contact? Because, of course, the contact with Asia between the East and the West, or at least through Europe, goes quite a ways back.
Well, we have some interesting dates. I mean, the overall thought was, my period is the modern period, and when did, quotation marks, the modern arrive in Asia? Well, that was the mid-19th century. And some dates line up in a rather peculiar way. The Opium Wars in China were kind of the beginning of the end for dynastic China. They were the 1840s. Mm-hmm. A decade later, Commodore Perry, the American, arrived in a bay south of Tokyo to, quotation marks, open Japan. And in India, the East India Company, which had managed English affairs in the subcontinent, I think since the 16th century, 17th century, gave way to what we call the Raj, and India became a colonial possession. That was 1858. So it all began then, and what was going on then that I wanted to get at? Well, 1850s, 60s, 70s were when Western countries were forming their idea of the modern world. Most notably, they were industrializing, and they consolidated a notion of progress that was just simply beyond question. It's a bit like certain ideas we hold now that are not up for discussion, and that became in effect our biggest export by way of either colonial possession or, in the cases of Japan and China, as I put it in the book, influence exerting relationships.
Mm-hmm. To me, the theory of the book, one of the theories, is that we have had this 150-year influence on the East. That's ending. Now the influence is coming back. Is that a fair assessment?
I think what I mean, I understand why you would arrive at that. My point is that the flow of influences or the flow of conversation, or however you wish to put it, is actually not going to stop and reverse. I think it's simply going to go in two directions. And that's what I wanted to suggest to readers, that to be modern is not an idea any longer that is going to simply, I like this word, emanate from the West. This is what's modern, and if you want to be modern, you have to do it this way. It won't be so, I don't think, any longer. Does it mean we will have nothing to contribute, and it's going to be a so-called Asian century? Emphatically, that's not my position. I just think contributions to human progress are going to come from multiple sources. That's what's interesting. The idea of an Asian century, I might add, is something, it arose in Western minds. I've never met an Asian who talks about the Asian century. That's our concoction. I don't think, as I say in the book, I don't think we're fated to have an Asian century. I think it's simply going to be non-Western, meaning our point of view is no longer going to be necessarily the dominant or only point of view. That's what I meant.
Callers, you can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We're talking with Patrick Smith, the author of Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Postmodern Post. There I go again. Post-Western World. Pantheon Books has published this fine book. Let's get specifically to a few of the, to the countries themselves. You open the book at a restaurant in rural Japan with your colleagues, and your colleagues are asking, where is the real Japan? So I ask the same question to you. Where is the real Japan? Is there a real Japan left after 150 years? And what does it mean to be Japanese?
Well, it's a wonderful question. I welcome it. My point with that little story, they were very good friends from Boston and remain so. When we talk about the real Japan, we must count everything that produced Japan as it sits in front of us right now. A search for anything else, paper fans and lanterns and splendid wooden restaurants in the middle of the countryside, it's all just a search for the exotic, and it's a bit orientalist. I think some, indeed, Japanese fall into the same trap. My point is the last 150 years is not to be erased. It's part of what Japan is. And that means we Westerners and all that we've brought over there is part of what Japan is. It's perfectly Japanese now to put on a suit and tie, right? It's perfectly Japanese if you find you want to consume your deep-fried pork with a knife and fork, go ahead. That was my point of that story. The word I used is a bit bold, I confess, but it was suggested to me by an Indian friend. Asia is, we must say, miscegenated, okay? The quotation marks, pure Asia, it doesn't exist anymore. All that has happened since the mid-19th century when the modern began in Asia counts. That's Asia. The rest is imagination, right? It's nostalgia. That was my point.
I love your definition of nostalgia, by the way.
Thank you. That
it's a form of depression, a certain inaccurate relationship with the past, a defense against the present, the past as a refuge. In the context of Asia and in this book, what do you mean by that? Was it the lanterns? Is it the...
Right. Let me tell you about something that's going on in China beyond all the auto plants and chip factories and all the rest of it that we preoccupy ourselves with. You find in among the Chinese quite a surprisingly visible, I cannot say prevalent, let's not exaggerate, but a surprisingly visible effort to revive the Confucian classics. And you have people taking classes and courses in in the old courtesies and bowing, and sometimes you have these little cults who wear Han Dynasty robes on weekends and so on and so forth. There's a Buddhist revival in China that's been much written about. It's very interesting to observe this, and one does not want to dismiss anyone's reconnection with their own traditions. But it's you follow the thread out, it's essentially nostalgic. It's essentially an attempt to erase or otherwise, so to speak, look over the shoulder of the last 150 years and long for what we once were. Mm-hmm. It's just not. It's just not possible to do that.
Well, we seem to, even in our short history here in the United States, we seem to have a nostalgic view of something that perhaps didn't exist, unless it was with media. I'm thinking of the sort of the nuclear home, the you know, the Eisenhower years, perhaps. We keep going back to that, and maybe that is a form of depression, a national form of depression on our part.
It's another kind of conversation. And
yes,
I'll enter into it any time you invite me. But
okay.
We are absolutely not immune from the phenomenon. You're quite
no.
right. Everything from car design to—I find the imagery of the Tea Party. I find it so fascinating. Having come back to America after many years away, you say, "Wait a minute! Three-cornered hats, banners that say 'Don't tread on me.' Which century are we purporting to be living in?"
Right? Oh, my goodness. Now, you write that what follows when people attempt to separate their identity and culture from an incoming way of life, and again, I'm thinking of this sort of fire hose of influence and culture and material goods flowing into a country like Japan, for instance. These imported things you write were merely objects that your way of life becomes pickled, like some kind of squid specimen or human organ immersed in a jar of formaldehyde. They're no longer living. And when I read that sentence, I thought of Japan adopting perhaps some of our crudest materialistic objects. But I want to know what you meant by that statement.
The Japanese and many who followed did something quite interesting when modern industrial civilization began to arrive, okay? And I want quickly to add that there's nothing particularly Asian about what they did. They separated out railroads, telegraphs, manifestations of 19th century material culture in the West from their own traditions and values. And so what they missed was that they are not separable. Railroads arose out of centuries of an entire culture of scientific investigation and so on and so forth. They are understood properly. They are cultural manifestations. A stock market reflects the culture in which it functions. That's why stock markets in Japan are different from stock markets elsewhere. And the New York market works this way, and the Chinese market works this way, and so on and so forth. Okay. The attempt to separate these things, as I said in the book, I consider it the most fateful mistake Asia ever made as it entered the modern world. And the consequence of it was a long and rather sadly wasteful effort to preserve things as if on life support or something. I don't know how else to put it. Or the image of the pickled human organ or what have you, right? It became dead. It had no relationship to life as it was being lived. Culture is a culture is an expression of life as it is lived. I suppose there are many definitions of culture, but that must be part of one of them. And if it's if it is not that, it is not living, you see? That's what I meant by that.
We're speaking with Patrick Smith, the author of Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Post-Western World. Callers, if you want to join the conversation, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's move on a little bit to India here, as if we can talk a little bit about such an incredible country. But let's first take a call. We've got a caller in Montgomery. Is that correct? Go ahead, caller. You're speaking with Patrick Smith.
Yeah, I saw excerpts of that book. A friend of mine is works at a bookstore, and he was reading stuff and in great stuff. But I'm really surprised that all these countries are growing so fast, and we seem to be lagging behind as much as we are. And, you know, the powers that be, I don't know if there's they understand this or what, because it just seems like the growth in the whole world, everybody's expanding, but yet, you know, the modern countries like us, maybe Great Britain and a few other people seem to be going by the wayside. And I don't know what if there's any reasoning behind it, but the economy of all these big big countries like China, for instance, really surprises me for being a communist country. And I was discussing this with a friend of mine who has a big business, and he says a lot of it has to do with they don't have restrictions. They don't have the taxes that we do. They don't have a lot of things that we do in this country that prevent our countries, our country, from and big labor. That's the other thing. They can get away with charging $1.50, you know, a day or something. Whereas it's got to be, you know, what is it, $80 an hour for a labor.
Do you have a specific question for Mr. Smith?
Well, I'm just curious. When you're comparing countries, do you compare what's happening to this country? Do you see it going backwards? Do you see us coming out? Manufacturing and how do you see us going? Where do you see us going in the next 10 years?
It's an interesting question with numerous ways at an answer. And it's fundamentally an economic question. I mean, I do think about these things. It's not quite what I'm after in the book, but certainly it's a welcome question. We're at different stages of development, okay? When you talk about a mature economy, things are built, okay? Things are accomplished. Indeed, all this applies to Japan, too. They have all the railroads they need. It makes a very great difference when the economy, the land itself is unbuilt. There's an enormous amount to do, right? So the opportunity for growth is simply much larger, right? And as economies mature, naturally enough, they slow down. That's part of it. I think we might want to stay away from the notion that people in China are freer to do what they like than say we Americans or our English friends. That's quite complicated. I can think of many terms to describe China, but free, my friend, is not one of them.
I would agree totally with you. One perspective following up on that caller, and I have a colleague who's Indian, who said that in the 1960s and 70s, India was hungry for foreign aid, yet now it contributes food and cash for international relief efforts. And it's come into its own, obviously, as you write in the book, and we all know that. But it gives one pause to remember those of us in our 50s who were growing up thinking about India as a country of beggars, almost.
People are starving in India was what my mother used to tell me when she wanted me to eat my cauliflower. I'd like to mention one more thing to the caller from Montgomery. Mm-hmm. No, I am not talking about an inevitable decline in America or the West or whatever. Again, it goes to the economics of it. I think it's another kind of conversation, but I do want to be clear on that. Mm-hmm. I am not talking about, it's not my take on what we're doing. Right?
We also have a caller from Effingham. Caller?
Yes. When people speak of China and India and Japan, only Japan seems to have worked at breakneck speed to keep its people in the flow of this prosperity. China and India have enormous amounts of population which live and toil in the most obscene poverty, whether they're working in a bicycle factory in Shanghai or whether they're out in the hinterland getting their livelihoods moved, mm-hmm. new dams being built. Why does no one ever mention that? I mean, China and India are growing, oh yes, but on the backs of the obscenely poor, it seems to me, and there's a tremendous gap in wage. All right, I will hang up.
Okay.
Thank you,
caller. Again, I think that goes back to how I opened the show, is that we look at these countries almost as if they're faceless economic engines, and we're not paying attention to the poverty that the caller mentioned.
We might bring some history to bear on this. Mm-hmm. The early decades of Japanese modernization were no less heartbreaking, as the caller finds things in India and China. And let's go further afield, right back to where we live. 19th century industrialization, if you know anything about the history of New York, but one could probably say Chicago or easily enough. Or Manchester in England. Think of how it was, right? Think of your favorite Dickens novel or something. It's nothing terribly Asian about this. I have more than some criticisms of what India and China may be doing by way of this, that, or the other policy. But yes, they have. Problems with, one could say, radical over-centralization of the process. It's Shanghai and the east coast of China. The hinterlands are far, far behind. In India, it's certain cities that are now becoming quite glamorous, Bombay and so on and so forth. But the village India is struggling, quite true. But we must put it in historical context. They are certainly further along than they were, and they'll keep going. And the numbers are there, 8% or so in China, and not quite that, but close in India.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to note that the middle class of India, which is around 300 million, is defined by someone making 87 American cents a day.
That came from a sociologist friend in Delhi. His name is Dipankar Gupta. He figures in the book. Very bright, alert man, willing to look further afield than whatever the mainstream accepted view is. And he's the one who helped me put that in perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful to him.
You're right. Stop worrying about poverty and prepare for prosperity, and referring to India. As Gandhi liked to put it, people with such thoughts do not know their India. And you continue by suggesting that India will use its eccentricity to methodically blend Indian improvisation. And I know I won't get this word right. You call it Jugaad?
Jugaad.
Yeah, with the Western model. What do you mean by that? You seem a little more, I don't want to say optimistic, that's not a good word to use here, but you seem to think that India is going to handle this new relationship perhaps better than China and Japan.
I think it has a chance to, and readers may detect I have an enormous affection for India.
Mm-hmm.
I used to say to people, working in China is ever absorbing and stimulating and thought-provoking. Working in India is all of those, but three-quarters of the time you forget you're working. I chose the word eccentricity carefully, and readers need to note that I use it a little differently than one might in an ordinary conversation. What I meant was they're very open to alternative ways to do things, and they have preserved this tendency, this cast of mind, very well. It's so fascinating to see how India will go at a problem and come up with a solution that others might never have thought of. And the distinction I want to draw quite sharply between India and China is this. China has adopted, in a somewhat unquestioning way, the straight-ahead definition of modernization that the West offered in the 19th century. It's entirely about material prosperity or advances towards such a state. Indians, I find, are tempted by this, but there's a lot hanging in the balance in India. And they may go forward, they have a chance to go forward, and I think one can only say that. They have a chance to go forward by finding solutions that arise from their specific conditions, not necessarily an off-the-shelf solution that worked in Chicago and therefore will work in Bombay, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to get at in India, and it's a tough thing to write about. No critique of my former colleagues in the newspaper industry, but it's hard to get that sort of thought into a daily newspaper.
We're speaking with Patrick Smith, the author of Somebody Else's Century, East and West in a Post-Western World. Our phone number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 if you want to join the conversation. Let's switch over to China a little bit.
Sure.
It's Uncle Wang's Tea House, right?
Yes.
The tearing down of the traditional houses in Beijing, I did read about this in several publications in preparation for the 2008 Summer Olympics.
They went a little mad before the Olympics.
Yeah, sort of like what Japan did following the war with their industrialism, sort of an irrational way of looking at things, perhaps. I don't know. But Uncle Wang says something very... it's very wise. I mean, it says, if you haven't got a past, you haven't got a future either. You can't go forward. So where's China headed as they seem to be wiping out all physical vestiges of its great history, though you have said that there is some nostalgia building for that?
Well, to be honest, Beijing was a splendid city of cobbled lanes and, you know, it was a very sort of atmospheric place full of its own past and so forth. And as I just suggested, the Chinese have the mainstream thinking in China is if we want to modernize, we have to westernize all this. So bulldoze down all those old houses and get rid of all those lanes and put in expressways and glass and concrete towers. That's it. And Beijing is an extremely difficult city to get around anymore because it's so overstuffed with expressways and it's not very pedestrian friendly and all that. I hope your listeners will get the idea of what I mean. They've just bought a model that we in the West often don't even like ourselves anymore. We look at what we've done to our cities and we're not very happy. but they're beginning to recognize that it leads to what I call in the book the bittersweet smile. And I tried very carefully not only to describe this phenomenon, but to introduce a couple of people who smiled in the bittersweet way. One was a friend of Uncle Wang's who lived in Dalian. A poor people are naturally going to be pleased with the prospect of material advances. But they are finding as they advance at an astonishing pace, it really is quite something to witness China in this way, they are finding themselves a bit marooned in the 21st century. They can't find their own past. They feel very unconnected. The old lanes come down and zippy new international-style houses and offices go up. But where are we, they ask themselves. What around us is Chinese any longer?
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the people you talked to in this region is a fishmonger. And
yes, I love that.
Yeah, I love that story too. And he says, what do Americans think of Chinese? And you say, most of us know China's growing quickly, but I'm not sure we know a lot more, how Chinese people think and feel, for instance. And he answers, how we think and feel? That's easy. Make China prosperous. Make China powerful.
Right.
That's an amazing story. I think it points to what you had just said.
That reflects the preoccupation with material advance. And once again, one cannot sit in the West and pronounce that that's inappropriate or somehow not to be desired. But I think it's fair enough to look at it holistically and say, this is what it brings if you're not careful.
Mm-hmm. So what does all this mean for us here in the United States? I mean, we don't have a track record of adjusting to other cultures exactly really well. And this seems to be a clarion call for us to remake ourselves. This is a great opportunity, I think, for the United States. And as you write, we can clash with other, quote, civilizations, or we can converse. The invitation to the latter is extended. It is ours to accept or decline.
I wrote the book, Stephen, for anyone who may be interested. I think for reasons your listeners may appreciate, I'm especially interested to hear from Asians or Asian Americans because they're familiar with what I'm talking about. And when they say I've got it right, it means a very great deal to me. But I wrote it for anyone who may want to enter on these topics. I did have America particularly in mind, and that becomes apparent in the third of the three essays. I think we live in a moment when, in my view, we would do well to learn to see differently. We would do well to look out at the world in a way as you noted, we are not accustomed to looking at it. The period from 1945 until the beginning of our new century was, or let's say until 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down, perhaps that's better, was what many of us, this was the period of my own growing up, many of us got used to what turns out to be an historically unusual predominance, okay? And it was a period in history that was not fated to be, to extend infinitely. And my point in the book, after moving around Asia for so long, was to say the world is changing and we need to alter our perspective and, if you will, locate ourselves differently in among our fellow human beings, right? And it's not a habit we have, but I wanted to suggest that we can acquire it. And it's part of what I think we Americans need to do to keep up with a world that is changing with dramatic speed. Sometimes I turn on the radio or read the paper here, and our preoccupations just astonish me. We are concerned with the tiniest little matters amid rather colossal changes going on around us.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to suggest that people might kind of, perhaps we can open our eyes a bit wider and understand ourselves as we really are among others.
I remember talking to an Israeli journalist, and I said, what do Americans not get about Israel? And he said, it's the amount of space that we have, the tiny amount of land that we live in. So I pose a question to you in the same way. What do we need to know about the East, and what do we not get? I mean, there's so much we don't get about Asia, but what is it that we need to know at this particular point in our history?
Well, an answer with more or less infinite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a question with more or less infinite answers. Let me try to go at it this way. I think we need to begin understanding that first point, that they have a perspective that is different from ours, and they are learning no longer to discard it in the name of modernization. They're kind of reassuming, they're re-inhabiting their own skins, if you will. They are beginning to say, we can be modern and still be Asian. And so their perspective is going to count more than we have long enjoyed the luxury of assuming it did not. You can see this even at the institutional level. Even a very few years ago, a worldwide problem would prompt a convening of the Group of Seven Western nations. Then it became the Group of Eight, with Russia, emphatically an Eastern nation, very emblematic of the East in many ways. And now when we pick up our newspapers, we read about the Group of 20, a multiplicity of voices. The Chinese are in it, the South Africans are in it, the Brazilians are in it, and so forth. And already this is how we go at our various challenges. So I think perspective, a word I use quite early in the book, is a good place for us to start.
And where do we find these perspectives? I mean, most Americans are not going to probably pick up the excellent publications that you write for. They're sitting there learning about Lindsay Lohan or something like that,
yes.
As you mentioned a little bit ago. I guess I would suggest just talking to people who are newly arrived here. Would that
opening
help?
Opening one's eyes wider, looking out from our very vast country, which is kind of a great thing in a liability at the same time. You can travel for days and never meet anybody but another American. And I suppose becoming conscious of the way one thinks and then trying to get through to the thought that there are other people who think differently. Hmm? There's an idea in at the end of the book. It's the thought of distance, having a certain distance from oneself so you can step back and see yourself. We made Asians do that in the 19th century. They had to step back and look at themselves and say, this is who we are. We seem to be behind the times, and this is who we need to become. It's not a straight line reversal, certainly not. But I think my point in the third essay was to say, just as we required that of Asians in the 19th century, I think the 21st requires us to step back and say, take a brand new look at ourselves and say, this is who we are, and this is who we need to become. Thought, you know, matters such as our notion of the individual and the Asian notion of the individual are quite different. And I question whether the Asian notion of the individual is not more appropriate for our time.
A stronger notion
of the individual as a member of a community.
And we certainly hold on to the individual very tightly in our own country.
Well, again, Stephen, forgive me for interrupting.
Oh, sure.
If we put our own experience in historical perspective, I think the idea of the individual that we formed for quite identifiable reasons in history, 18th century history, 19th century history, the settling of the frontier and so forth, we might arrive at the conclusion that our idea of the individual is quite an unusual idea of the individual, and it's not shared by very many other people.
Patrick, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off. We have run out of time. Thank you so much for being my guest today. And again, the book is called Somebody Else's Century by Patrick Smith. And if you want to understand the world in which we live, not the world we wish to imagine, please pick up this book. Thank you.